Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Lunatics Radio Hour podcast. I'm Abby Branker. I'm here with Alan Kudan.
Hello.
And today we are also here with Bob Don.
Hi.
Hi, Bob. So if you're not familiar with Bob, he has two amazing shows, Bob Short Story Hour podcast and Hidden Oaks, which I'll let him tell you a little bit about both of them. But Alan and I have become very big fans of both, and we're so excited to have him on the show today.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here. And that's extremely kind. I take it as an enormous compliment for you to say you're fans of my shows. Bob Short Story Hour is a podcast I've done for the longest period of time. It's like going on 6 years now.
Wow.
And it's just this kind of weird anthology. I was looking for a podcast myself that just explored different genres and authors, both, you know, classic and contemporary, because you get in your circles and you kind of run out of new books to read or something. You find yourself stuck in these ruts, and I couldn't find one for years. And I had a background like recording audio for music and stuff. And finally, a couple of my friends just said, why don't you start the podcast that you're looking for if you can't find it? And so I did, and it's this way to just, you know, kind of explore different authors and also help like new up-and-coming authors get a platform where maybe they wouldn't have gotten out to people if they are having trouble getting published or anything like that. So I really like it for those reasons. It's a lot of fun, and I get to explore just all kinds of cool stories. And then I do a lot of just whatever I want on there too. I'll just talk about random things with people. So you guys will be on there soon.
Yeah, we're so excited.
I am too.
As soon as, because Abby, you guys got in contact beforehand. And as soon as I listened to one of your episodes and heard your voice, it just blew my mind. You just have such a good presence. And it's wonderful just to hear you read me a story.
Yeah. Alan and I always talk about, it's like a big thing because Alan's very big into audiobooks. It's kind of like his preferred method of listening to books or consuming books. And one of the big points of contention is like the narrator, right? Because oftentimes you'll buy like a book because you're like, oh, I really want to read this book. But then the narrator it's like hard to get into it. And we've talked about how like if you were the narrator of these audiobooks, it would be so easy to listen to them.
That's awesome. Again, that's such a huge compliment because I really struggle with it. It's this kind of internal battle too. I'm really self-conscious about my voice. I'm really hard on myself about it because it fails me sometimes, and I just never know if it's doing a good job. So the feedback is amazing. Thank you.
Well, I hope you take commissions because there's a bunch of books that I would love. I absolutely love the story, but the readers are just awful. So we might be in contact soon.
I will do private recordings for you for the books.
Thank
that you.
You want.
Yeah, because a narrator can make or break a story.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there was a time where I was renting multiple books from the library, audiobooks at a time. I had like an hour and a half commute, so I was just constantly listening. And yeah, I'd just return half of them right away because I get a chapter in and I'm like, yeah, I can't listen to this person for 20 hours. There's no way.
Yeah, exactly. And then Hidden Oaks. So Hidden Oaks is a little spookier. So we would love to hear about that too.
Definitely. That was like a project that we've worked on for years, but only started to be released during COVID. And originally I thought I was just going to be the narrator and like audio producer of it. And then in one of our early meetings, the head writer, Patrick Marsh, he was basically like, no, you and the other audio engineer, you're going to be like one third writers of the show. okay. And I had never written anything in my life, but he was like, you're like a prolific reader, so you're going to be excellent at writing. So anyway, yeah. It's this like kind of arcane, like Lovecraftian monster story. Takes place in 1990s Minnesota. In the suburbs, and that's it. It's like a period piece, and it explores a lot of just issues that people have in their lives, trauma they're dealing with and stuff, but like in the scope of also dealing with this monster and stuff. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, we love it. It's very spooky. And then on top of all of that, you're also a psychiatric nurse practitioner.
That's right.
Because, you know, all things usually just, it's the normal trinity.
Yeah. I know. Yeah, like where else would I be able to really explore all these like deep, horrifying traumas and things without, you know, having that as my background?
Seriously, it's funny. My therapist is very into horror, and it's actually been really awesome. And I think her husband I don't know obviously what he does, but he has some sort of connection to the horror industry as well. And so a lot of our conversations are like through the lens of horror, and it makes it really easy to understand and also really interesting for this part of my life, right? With the Lunatics Radio Hour and the Lunatics Project, because horror really is super psychological. And I think in a lot of cases, the more rooted it is in that kind of reality, the more relatable and also scary it can be.
Absolutely. Like, and if we think about a lot of the pop culture horror that, you know, we either watch on film or read, that it is kind of a vehicle for that. And you guys have talked about it on your show, and I hope when we meet and do one of my episodes, it's something that we'll get into. But
yeah,
it's just a vehicle for kind of exploring a lot of other issues that are going on in people's lives that usually are rooted in some sort of psychological analysis. Whether it's individuals or even society, right? The monster isn't always the monster. Sometimes it's actually like the town or what's going on in somebody's life.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that leads us really well into our topic today. So today we are talking about the history of pyromania and pyrokinesis. We started out with this idea of doing the history of pyromania, and through the research, and Bob, thank you so much for helping me with the research for this, but through that, I really personally learned a lot, and it definitely shaped some misunderstandings that I had about it. So we decided to tackle pyrokinesis as well, because I think looking at them together is very interesting when it comes to horror and how people, I think of pyromania as something that it's not.
Absolutely.
Well, it also doesn't hurt that when we first discussed this episode, I exclusively heard pyrokinesis. So I just did a bunch of research on that. And then we found out that it's on pyromania. It's like, okay, we'll just do a two-part episode.
Well, it's honestly like, it's so connected. And I think the words are used sometimes interchangeably wrong, right? And even when you bring in like arson, we're going to talk about all of this. But I think it makes a lot of sense to look at all of these things like laid out together, because people, I think, use the words interchangeably, and it's not talking about the right thing. So I think it was a happy accident.
They're very different.
They're very different, yeah.
Can I ask what the like jumping off point for this was, or what sparked it in your mind?
We usually are sitting there and like, hey, you know, it'd be a cool episode.
And then we add it to like a list of like 100. And so we have this huge list. And then every like few months, I say to Alan, okay, I think we should do these 3 or 4. And he's like, yeah, okay, cool. That sounds good. Like, there's movies I want to watch or whatever. And so I don't know. Like, I don't honestly remember how it got on the list, but it was on the list. And we were like, okay, the time is now for pyromania.
Perfect.
Pyromania is a fairly common trope in horror films and books. And we found that there's a lot of misconception around what it really is. The term is often misused or misunderstood. In reality, it's very rare to be a pyromaniac. And by definition, you are not committing crime or destruction with fire for the purposes of hurting another person. So today's sources, we looked, as always, at Wikipedia. Also, thanks to Bob for pages from Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Health Disorders, 5th edition, American Psychiatric Association, 2013, a page 6 article by Derek Bryce and Tyler, Very Well Mind article by Amy Marin, and an article on Slate by Jesse Baring. Before we get into the history of pyromania, we should first have a solid understanding of what it is, especially because we as a society often use the term pyromania incorrectly and casually.
So just like a lot of behavioral disorders, and this kind of goes into that initial misconception that you guys brought up, I can even think back to when I was a little kid. I loved fire. I still love fire. I have a lot of bonfires at my house. And you know, when I was a kid, I remember like playing with fireworks and blowing up little Lego houses and stuff, right? And you think like, oh man, I was such a pyromaniac when I was a little kid. Or you'll hear people throw stuff around like, you know, I'm super organized in my house and that's my OCD. But in reality, it's always kind of, especially diagnostically, like we're looking at when it comes down to functioning in your life. And with pyromania, it's the same thing. Like you might have a like for fires or something, but that's not the same as like the impulse control aspect of it, which is really what we kind of get into with this. Your life isn't ruined because you start fires. Like we're talking about somebody that would go to work and not be able to not light the trash can on fire because they have this you know, thing in their mind that's just nagging them. Like, you have to start that on fire, otherwise something bad's going to happen or something. So there's this real difference. It's not ruining your life because you can't control it. That's like an easy way to kind of explain the difference.
Yeah, totally. That's helpful too. And I didn't even think about it that way too, of with an impulse control disorder, like you literally can't control, you know, like I have this thing and I've done this before too, where I say like, oh, I have OCD because when I leave my house, I have to lock my door. Like, well, obviously I lock my door, but then I literally check my door like 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times, right? Because I'm like, is it locked? Is it really locked? Is it really locked? But it's not rude. Like, I could, if I was very mindful in that moment, I could walk away and, like, you know, and so it's like that people kind of colloquially use these psychiatric terms that are not diagnosed and then become kind of almost less powerful in a way.
Right. Yeah. It goes into like destigmatizing it too, and realizing what it is and what it's not. And like you mentioned, you know, the OCD thing, like rituals, like the door lock checking is, I see OCD quite a bit. It's like pretty common, you know, not extremely common, but you know, I see it in real life. And that's a good example. But again, you like compare it to, is this a realistic fear? You guys live in New York City. I would check my doors all the time too. I mean, I would like, I leave my house unlocked here when I go to the store, you know, I don't even think it. You know, I have patients that'll do the door and window checking, but they're like late to work by an hour because they can't leave it, you know, and that's that difference.
Yeah. I actually work with someone occasionally. And this was the, who has a legitimate OCD. And this was my first knowing interaction. And the way theirs manifests is that cables always have to be perfectly straight. Yeah. And on, I work in the film industry. There's cables everywhere that, you know, are outside this person's department. You know, at first it seems very odd, but then when you see everyone going out of their way to make it so that this person isn't going out of their mind, because like they know it's just their tick. It's a straight up disorder that you have to be very mindful of, because if you do this little thing, that's a little thing to you, suddenly they are able to do their job with no consequences.
Yeah. Wow. That's really nice though, that everyone on set like band together. I was not expecting the story to go that way.
And I worked with this person just recently for the second time. It's because it had been a while, and then all of a sudden, when I see everyone doing, I'm like, oh, that's how I know this person.
That's funny. At its very core, pyromania is defined as an obsessive desire to set things on fire. We should be very clear that pyromania is different from arson. Arson is the illegal crime of setting fire on purpose. While some pyromaniacs may commit arson, not everyone who commits arson is a pyromaniac. Arson committed by pyromaniacs is the second leading type of arson, though that statistic, I found a few different versions of it based on the resource that I was looking at. Only second, though, to revenge arson, which is by far the majority. So setting a fire in order to hide a crime or cover up evidence does not qualify as pyromania.
So I just want to clarify for a second. So you're saying when you burn somebody's stuff because you're angry,
yeah,
that's revenge arson.
Correct.
And just things deliberately set on fire for seemingly no reason would be the second cause of pyromania arson.
Yeah. So again, there's multiple, it's really hard, and we'll get into this. It's really hard to identify someone as a pyromaniac, especially if there is an overlap with arson, because A, it's really hard to catch arsonists, and B, if it's well done.
It is.
It's actually less than 3% in the U.S. of arson fires end in conviction. And then on top of that, less than 1% of the population is actually could ever experience or ever has experienced pyromania. So it's like this very kind of like elusive thing to catch and to define.
I just have like a fun little tidbit about arson.
Okay, please.
So years ago, I did a film shoot, a series of film shoots for the New York Fire Department.
Mm-hmm.
And they were doing a bunch of test burns. There was a whole bunch of buildings out on Governor's Island that were being decommissioned and demolished.
Mm-hmm.
And the fire department stepped in and said like, hey, we want to burn these down. And they said, okay. I'm sure there was more of a back and forth before that, you know, just the okay. But what they wanted to do was they just wanted to see how modern, like do clinical tests by how modern homes burn, because these tests had been completed, but back in the 50s, mm-hmm. 50s and 60s. And like, you know, a CRT television burns very differently than a flat screen. Mm. Modern furniture is completely different. Right. And the way that this falls into pertains to arson is that arson used to be a lot easier to detect because of there's usually like a very clear origin spot, because that's where the gasoline was dumped there, because you know you're using a petroleum propellant. But modern furniture and textiles is all petroleum based.
Scary.
That's another reason why they were trying to do all these test burns, because basically your whole home is made of incredibly flammable things, chock full of fire retardant. What that means is there's a lot of the science that goes into like the flash point.
Yeah.
Previously, they used to either break a window or not break a window, depending on the structure, to see like, you know, to curb ventilation, everything. But none of that works once you hit flash point. And then the ambient temperature just naturally causes things to erupt without even flames. So yeah, they were just trying to do all these different tests to see how our stuff burns.
Wow, that's interesting.
So basically plastics and the oil industry has made it easier for arsons to get away with.
Absolutely.
Right? That's okay. Interesting.
So yeah, you have big plastic to thank. So clearly there's a conspiracy to help arsonists.
Of course.
Just again, going over this. So setting a fire in order to hide a crime or cover up evidence does not qualify as pyromania. The impetus to start the fire also can't be driven by hallucinations. It cannot be tied to delusional behavior or impaired judgment, right? So if somebody's having like a psychotic episode and they set a fire, it's not the same as having pyromania in that being the thing that drives you to start the fire. Would you agree with that, Bob?
Yeah, because so it's always just like in medicine, like we're always trying to rule out another diagnosis, right? And so if somebody is having hallucinations and they see these monsters coming at them and they've got like schizophrenia, or maybe they're bipolar manic and their manic episodes have, you know, psychosis with hallucinations, it's really because of that they're starting the fires, right? Not something that's organic in nature, just around the control of not being able to control starting fires or something.
Yeah, totally. And also pyromaniacs don't actually have a desire to harm anyone, right? So it's a kind of about this internal release, not anything to do with causing harm or destruction. So again, it's an impulse control disorder. Those who are inflicted are unable to stop themselves from setting objects alight. It's believed that less than 1% of the population experience pyromania during their lifetime. It's generally thought that these actions help to relieve stress, and that's obviously like an oversimplification of it. But to qualify as a pyromaniac, the person also needs to start a fire more than once. They repetitively desire setting fires and are unable to control this impulse. And usually a crescendo of emotions precedes the act of actually lighting the fire, resulting in a feeling of euphoria or release for the person. Some pyromaniacs also experience a fascination with fire, an attraction to fire-setting tools, setting off fire alarms, interest in local fires, and this I think is really interesting, interest in firefighters and other institutions that are associated with fire or fire prevention. So some pyromaniacs even set fire to fire departments or alternatively become firefighters. And there's also an element of fascination or interest in the aftermath of the fire.
Huh.
Isn't that interesting?
A lot of layers going on there.
Yeah. I think it makes sense, though. I mean, if you're like just consumed with the idea of starting fires, or you just have fires on the mind constantly, that's where your interests would go. Just like any of us that nerd out about Star Trek or something, you know, we can't let it go. So, you know, you end up on a cruise with Patrick Stewart and.
I'm just wondering if Alan's going to start talking about Star Trek now or not.
No, I'm going to stop myself right there because you're giving me the look.
No, I'm not. So let's first start by talking about what impulse control disorders are. You may be more familiar with kleptomania, the inability to resist urges to steal or take something that doesn't belong to you.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like, so you get into the impulse control disorders. And you know, OCD is the one that I like to keep going back to. It's like the one I put in the notes because it's really relatable for people. They at least have some concept of what that is. And again, you know, we talked about the colloquialisms, like people just self-diagnosing OCD because they're really organized or clean or something. It's a great way to start because the if we break that down in just the nomenclature, obsessive compulsive disorder. So they're all kind of that in a way. The obsession part is the thoughts and the compulsion part is the behaviors. So if you think about it like that, there's this constant mental process of just obsessing over this, whatever the thing is. Maybe yeah. It's stealing with kleptomania or, you know, OCD is kind of broad, but usually some kind of ritual, like you have to do this. And the anxiety piece, and like you mentioned before, where there's this like stress relief when somebody does the compulsion part, the behavior. And why that is because usually there's some sort of thought distortion that is really tightly tied with that obsession part. Like if I don't start the fire, something bad's going to happen. And it's usually not a necessarily reasonable thought, but that's why right. It's a problem, right? Like if I don't start the fire, these children are going to get hurt or whatever. And then the compulsion in actually doing it just relieves all that pressure. The thoughts go away. You're not having just this wheel turning of the obsession anymore because you did the thing. And so there's just this release of feelings there. The interesting thing is that some of the impulse control disorders, and I don't know if we get into this somewhere later, are kind of treatable with medications. Mm. Like OCD is a lot of the serotonin agents like SSRIs that people are fairly commonly associated with, they treat some of the issues that come up with that. Like you can see someone's obsessions kind of decrease and they don't do the rituals anymore just with a relatively simple course of like Prozac or something like that. And that works. I don't know necessarily why, but it does. But a lot of these other impulse control disorders, kleptomania, gambling disorders, and pyromania, they have these roots in like the dopamine reward center of the brain. Like I don't want to get yeah. too in the weeds in this, but when we think about addictions, that's kind of the same thing that we think about. Like you get this just internal euphoria. It's like taking drugs when you yeah. when you do the compulsion piece, and that is way stronger than what we can control with like medications. And so in terms of that, it's really hard to treat them. We usually don't even consider doing any kind of treatment for this because it just doesn't work. And so it's a lot more therapy based, a lot more like finding coping mechanisms and teaching mindfulness of like, okay, you're going to have these obsessions probably for the rest of your life, but we just have to find ways to work around it and realize that you're going to ruin your life if you keep doing it.
The gambling thing is interesting because in a lot of the research, I found pyromania was being likened to gambling. And I guess like when it comes to like gambling as an addiction, there's a lot of similarity between them.
Yeah, they're all kind of in that same category of diseases of the mind. Yeah. Kleptomania, same way. But yeah, just some strong impulse to do a thing and then compulsions to do that thing to make the obsessions go away.
I'm just so surprised that these conditions can be treated with medication. I find that so surprising. It seems like 100% you'd have to just therapy, you know?
Well, yeah, that's what he's saying, that it's really hard to treat them because the relief you would get doesn't compete with the euphoria
gotcha.
Of actually doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. There's some like OCD for some reason kind of separates itself from these, but mm-hmm. A lot of the other impulse control ones, it's almost impossible to do anything other than therapy.
Got it.
Another one that's really hard that's in the same category, and it's a little gross to think about sometimes, but like skin picking disorder is in the same thing. People that just like constantly are picking and whatever, it's like super rewarding to their brain, like pick that scab, and just very, very, very hard to get people to stop doing it.
It's not, I don't want to open a whole can of worms either, but my initial thought too, when I was researching this, is sort of that to me, it feels like there's also some similarity to certain eating disorders, like the sense yep. of like bulimia specifically, like the sense of compulsion and then relief after, right? Like this crescendo of emotions and then the relief from actually doing the thing.
Yeah, I thought about relating those as well. They're a little different. There's not as much in the reward centers there, and that's a lot more like body dysmorphia yeah. and people having really distorted thoughts about what they look like that are associated with that. But there are some of those obsessions that tie in, for sure. Yeah.
Can we never do an episode on necrophilia, please?
Sure, yeah.
Thank you.
I can agree to that.
I didn't bring it up. That's the second time I've heard you bring that up in a show.
There are some who believe that the general diagnosis of fire starting as a conduct disorder can lead to pyromaniacs going undetected. Specifically, calls to mind oppositional defiant disorder.
So yeah, that's like where what we would think of as like kids that just have this just defiance to anybody kind of telling them what to do. So like any kind of institution, you know, school, law enforcement, parents, they're basically just going to not listen to the rules or just be defiant in general against anybody telling them no. And that makes sense. Like, I think it is fair to touch on that because it is one thing that we struggle with. And in the psychiatric community, even there's like diversions of thought on stuff like this. Like, should we be diagnosing this in childhood? Should we not? How many of these things change when you hit a certain age? And then is it detrimental to have diagnosed a kid with this? Like, how does that follow them through their life and make, you know, significant barriers for them down the road? So it is this like delicate balance. And a lot of us, if we're doing our job deliberately and ethically, we're trying to just be aware of that. And what they're saying here about the conduct disorder thing is, yeah, I think it could be really easy to just say, oh, this is just a kid who just got into a lot of trouble and, you know, started fires just to kind of be a punk or they, you know, they were defiant about all different kinds of things. And then because of that diagnosis following them through their life and being on their chart or something, it might get missed because you're thinking, right. Well, this is just part of this other thing that they've got going on. If you just happen to get other providers in their life down the line who aren't astute or aren't like reassessing that diagnosis, that's probably very true.
Also, so speaking of causes, usually pyromania is first identified when the individual is a child or teenager, which we've talked about, right? Statistically, it affects men and women, but it is significantly more prominent in men. There are thought to be multiple pathways or factors that can cause this disorder. People who are impacted by other disorders, substance abuse, we already talked about gambling, bipolar, antisocial personality disorder, all of those people seem to be at higher risk for pyromania. And again, I think maybe it calls into question what you just said, Bob, about things start to kind of get a little blurry and it might be hard to detect things when there's other things going on.
Right.
Studies have also found that there seems to be great crossover between people who have been sexually or physically abused and the development of pyromania.
Yeah, that's like huge with most mental illness. Like trauma is the root cause of so much of this. And I wrote down just some like basic anecdotal statistic there, but can almost certainly say, even if we looked it up, it's higher than 50%. And even then, I would posit that any of these statistics that we see, it's likely higher than that, because how do yeah. you really quantify this? You know, how many people don't even end up telling anybody about some abuse or trauma? Even if they are seeking help, it's just a hard thing to talk about. And it's tricky to say like how those things tie together. Like lives and variables are extremely complex, but trauma is at the root of a lot of this without getting into the weeds on it.
Yeah. Yeah. There is still some debate over whether pyromania is connected to sexual satisfaction in any way. And I'm curious to see what your thoughts are on this. In Germany during the late 18th century, doctors believed that pyromaniacs were typically, and I'm quoting here, teenage girls with low IQ who got a sexual release from fire setting. There's actually a Prussian word, Feuerlust, meaning fire lust. Freud also associated fire setting with unresolved sexual trauma, and he quoted the myth of Prometheus as support that his theory of fire and sexuality are connected.
I was waiting for Freud to come in.
Yeah, as soon as you said sexual satisfaction, I'm like, this is Freud.
Yep.
I feel like I talk about Freud way too often on this podcast, but I don't know.
I think there's a reason for that.
Are you going to go into like Oedipal complexes and stuff now?
That was the last episode.
We just did the last episode that we just recorded is on Psycho. And so we talk about it quite a bit.
You get the best of psychiatry and Greek myths. That's perfect.
It was perfect for us, yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, I don't know, you get back to the Freud stuff and maybe, I mean, there is a really strong basis in all of what we do, even a lot of the psych-specific stuff that has diverged significantly from Freud and these type of, like, sexual-centered things, which, you know, again, maybe in some cases there's some small tie there. And we already talked about like some possible physical or sexual abuse history that ties into this. So maybe, but again, it's like a case by case thing. I wouldn't make any like generalizations and they had this just thought about that stuff back then. But I don't want to like dismiss Freud either, because again, like even though we've diverged from him in a lot of things, there's this basis in the work that he did. And there's a lot that got exposed back during that era about trauma in childhood and just abuse in general, because he was willing to have those conversations with people. Like if you look at the statistics back then, you see just this enormous spike after the work that he and some of his colleagues started to do in the rates of abuse. And it's just because people were starting to talk about it finally. I do give credit there.
Yeah, totally.
That makes a lot of sense.
So we talked a little bit about treatments, but just to tie things up in a bow, the most effective known treatment is cognitive behavioral therapy. This type of therapy seeks to undo social learnings and reverse harmful behavior. And we already talked about the fact that pharmaceuticals aren't super helpful with pyromania, but that mindfulness, like you said earlier, Bob, and mm-hmm. talk therapy seem to be the best way to, again, not to cure something, but to try to help it be more manageable, I suppose, and less destructive.
Right.
And the only other note here is that it's important to identify and treat pyromania as soon as possible, obviously, right, in order to try to prevent possible devastating outcomes of fire setting.
Yeah, and not only that, but a lot of times the longer you let these things go, the more rooted they become in somebody's mind. It's harder to undo the work of like serious negative thought loops that have become a normal part of somebody's life. And so when it becomes chronic, if it hasn't been even touched on yet, like you're going back through and trying to undo years or decades of these tangled up, difficult to control thought processes. So earlier is always better.
So there's not actually a ton of history that we're going to get into because, again, it is so elusive, but there are some things to talk about. So historically, starting in the 1800s, pyromania had not been properly studied or categorized. At the time, it was considered, and I'm quoting here, something called moral insanity, which was a disorder that was used to diagnose patients through the end of the 19th century. Moral insanity is loosely defined as abnormal emotions and behaviors. This was interesting. So psychologists in Finland did a study in the 1990s to try and understand the overlap between pyromania and arson. Nina Lindberg and her team from the University of Helsinki looked at cases between the years of 1972 and 1993, and they found, of the Finnish men who had been detained for setting fires, 68% had been drunk upon arrest. They also discovered that repeat offenders had a history of alcohol abuse and mostly had other personality disorders. From this case study, it was concluded that using the current definition of pyromania is incredibly rare, even thought to be a phenomenon in some cases. Though there is a comment in the study that calls out the fact that those who are incredibly skilled at arson often go uncaught, as we talked about, in the United States, only 3% of fires believed to be arson actually end with a conviction.
So are there any famous pyromania cases?
And so that's the thing. I really struggled, and I don't know if anyone else found anything, but I was kind of expecting, right, to find, like, here are some famous pyromaniacs that we're going to talk about. And I couldn't really find anybody to, and there was like a few, like an unit, like there was one study that was done where in the United States where a person experiencing homelessness had been studied at, and thought to be like a pyromaniac. But again, it wasn't like a huge crusade of like said it, you know, it wasn't like this big news thing. There was not like a ton of famous pyromaniacs that I could find, or like infamous pyromaniacs.
Yeah, it's surprising. You would think that there would be some more. I don't know. Fires are so interesting.
Yeah.
We made the clear delineation between a pyromaniac and an arsonist. And obviously there's some famous arsonists out there, but they all have motivations which rule them out for pyromania.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing. It was like a lot of like super, we could definitely do like an arson, you know, episode at some point, because there's some fascinating arson stories out there, but it's hard to say, oh, this person, a lot of them were also like in the mafia. And so it's hard to say like, oh, this person is a pyromaniac versus this person's in
had nothing to do
mafia.
With Big Tony telling him to go, you know, burn down the docks.
Right. Exactly.
That's a really interesting thing, though, because I think about I used to read a bunch of true crime, and I think about some of the like serial killers that I read about who were hitmen for the mafia. And it's like, that could be something, you know, they'll sometimes look for a person who is already, let's say, for example, with the pyromaniacs, like who's already really inclined to do the thing that they're looking for. And then does that take away from anybody diagnosing it in the future? Because they're like, well, they started all these fires because they were in the mob and whatever. But then it's motivated, right? It takes away the ability to.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the chicken or the egg all over again.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably why in some cases it's hard to say like, oh, this person's a pyromaniac, because they could have joined a thing that we could see as motivation, but you don't know like what's kind of like the impetus of it.
Right.
So this is sort of a silly example, but I thought that we would throw it in because it comes up a lot when you Google pyromania. In First We Feasts, which they have a YouTube channel where they have folks, usually celebrities or always celebrities, you know, eat a series of, it's called Hot Ones, eat a series of increasing spiciness chicken wings. And that's kind of like the premise of their interview show. On this show.
You're talking about Hot Ones?
Yeah.
Okay.
On this show, Michael B. Jordan, who, you know, is from Black Panther, among other things, talked like a little bit jokingly about being a pyromaniac when he was a child. So he said he started by lighting his grandmother's incense on fire. Not the way, obviously, you're supposed to, but like literally setting the entire thing on fire, right? And then quickly turned into him pushing the lit incense through the shower curtain, burning holes in it. So I just thought it was interesting because there's actually like a lot of news outlets that covered this after he was on the show that were like, Michael B. Jordan is a pyromaniac, you know, and it's like, I don't know if he was like diagnosed or not, but I thought we should address it because if you go Googling trying to find a case, you're going to come across this like media attention that he got for the interview.
That's interesting.
Okay, so all of that being said, we're going to pivot rather sharply and talk about pyrokinesis. And again,
here we go.
We should say this is not, you can be, I think, Bob, you said this to me in an email, right? Like, you can be a pyromaniac and a pyrokinetic, but you also don't need to be. You could be just one or the other.
Right.
You can be a pyrokinetic without having pyromania.
Sure.
You could be a pyrokinetic who's also a pyromaniac and an arson.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Then you really get into it. And you're in the mafia. And it's like, who knows, you know?
I see the movie already.
I know. Well, for me, it goes into like, obviously, this is going to come up in a D&D campaign now where you've got some, you know, fight sorcerer just like blasting fireballs for like the Order of the Gauntlet or something as a hitman.
Well, I mean, it's because it starts in the teenage years. They'd have, you know, kindle bonfire first.
Right. Of course. Of course.
Pyrokinesis is the ability for a human to start and control fire with their mind. Though all cases of pyrokinesis have been identified as hoaxes, we're talking about like within the real world, obviously, we should call out that there are real life investigations into them. We should also caveat that pyrokinesis is not related to pyromania, as we just said. So we're not saying that this is the paranormal version of pyromania at all, right? Pyrokinesis is not believed to be a psychological or paranormal extension of pyromania. Rather, because there is some misunderstanding between the two, especially within horror.
And especially with me.
And especially with Alan. We thought we'd take the time to identify this as well. So this is, I think, super fascinating. The word pyrokinesis wasn't actually a word until Stephen King used it in his novel Firestarter. It was obviously taken from the words pyro and telekinesis.
Seriously?
Ironically, etymologists have found that the actual correct word would be telepyrosis, or fire from a distance.
Cool.
I had no idea.
Telepyrosis.
That's amazing. I mean, the funny thing is that that's the book that came to mind when I was reading through the original outline.
Yeah. Huh. And we're going to, we watched the movie last night and we'll talk about it at the end of the episode, but it very interesting. I also wrote for Lunatic's Library. I wrote this like pyrokinesis story about a little girl and just watched the movie last night and then realized how similar some of them are. So it really is kind of like a little close-knit genre, I feel like.
I beg to differ. The world is your oyster when it comes to pyrokinesis. You just got to broaden some horizons.
Well, isn't that always the case? There are a few, and I'm quoting here, real-life cases of pyrokinesis that are worth touching on. Daniel Dunless Holm was a Scottish medium born on March 20th, 1833. He was famous for his ability to levitate, communicate with the dead, and elicit knocking noises from them, similar to the Fox sisters, which we covered in our spiritualism series.
So obviously he was a necromancer.
Yes, exactly. He was communicating with the dead. Yes. Our dear friend Harry Houdini had this to say about Daniel. He was, and I'm quoting here, one of the most conspicuous and lauded of his type and generation, and the forerunner of the mediums whose forte is fleecing by presuming on the credulity of the public.
What?
He was not a fan.
Oh, I was going to say, Houdini doesn't believe shit.
Oh, I was going to say, I almost started reading that as Houdini praising him and saying he actually was doing this stuff. I was about to be really surprised.
If you get the endorsement of Houdini, holy cow.
Yeah, he did not.
Okay.
Despite Houdini's take and eyewitness accounts who claimed to have seen Daniel's tricks, he had a good run of it. So it was interesting because he had a pretty devout following during the spiritualism era, but like many, many people went to his house, where like his parlor, right, where he had kind of like his setup to do seances and things. And they were like, very obviously, this is a hoax, like as we see with all spiritualists, really. But he still kind of had like a pretty strong following. One of his claims to fame was his use of fire. He would take a hot coal from the fire and handle it with ease. The idea is that he was using mental powers to control the temperature of the object, right? Or he was arming his hand somehow. And so there are several theories around how he was doing this. One, that it was really a juggling trick, that he was moving the coal too quickly to let the heat burn him, right? That he was just throwing it, passing it between his hands really fast. Others think that he was tricking everyone by using platinum or another heat-resistant material disguised as coal, so that when he picked it up from the fire, it was actually, to quote Gandalf, quite cool.
Oh,
interesting.
A.W. Underwood was, again, pyrokinetic in quotes, who was a bit flashier with his fire tricks. Underwood was believed by some to actually have the power to set items on fire, though academics and other illusionists believe he was using hidden pieces of phosphorus to cause the fire, sort of like throwing them and kind of like having like little explosions happen around, which was definitely very fast and loose, I think.
I'd watch him.
Yeah, I feel like you could be a bystander, you know, like casualty of war.
I mean, not if he's a phony, because then he's like...
Nobody's throwing phosphorus, but they think it's like him setting fireballs or whatever, but he's like literally throwing chemicals around the stage.
Hmm.
Just don't wear like your windbreaker.
I'd assume that he had like pre-rigged areas, like covered in propellant, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so like he just was casting a spark on something that would naturally burst into flames.
Sure.
So he's not gonna like just hit you with it and you wouldn't catch fire.
Okay.
But that's his telekinetic power, you know,
right,
holding himself back.
Yeah.
It makes me think too about like some of the stuff that I've read about some of the Far East, I'm doing big air quotes, like sorcerers. You know, the whole like disappear in a cloud of smoke thing, you know, that stuff was real. They found uses for gunpowder and stuff like that to to make that happen. And it's no different than these kind of like parlor tricks, I think.
Hmm. Ooh, I love that. I have not encountered that. And I love the idea of people disappearing in clouds of smoke like many, many years ago.
So yeah. Please put it on the list. Far East sorcerers. We got to do some research.
Adding it to our list. Okay. Oh, this one is my favorite case because it's a little bit recent. Most notable of all cases of pyrokinesis is that of a 3-year-old girl in the Philippines. And very interesting that this case is from 2011. This young girl supposedly had the ability to predict or control fire with her mind. The mayor of the town, and the town was called Antique in the Philippines, or is called Antique in the Philippines, claimed to have seen her powers himself. The story goes that he witnessed a girl saying, "Fire, pillow," seconds before a pillow went up in flames. And he isn't the only witness. The story gained media attention when more and more people came forward with similar reports, apparently seeing the girl predict fire without any physical contact or closeness to the objects in question. And this was actually part of, the details are a little bit hazy, but I believe it was part of a documentary that came out fairly recently, but then the documentary was pulled for legal, like I think separate legal issues, so I couldn't actually find
it.
Yeah, but I'm very fascinated and I really want to try to track down more about this story because it's pretty recent. It sounds like an X-File to me.
You know somebody listening has got a pirated version of that documentary.
Send it in. films.lunatics@gmail.com. We want to see it.
Well, I mean, yeah, every other one of these examples is like, here's why we think they are. And the last thing is, and here's how they were debunked.
Yeah.
We don't have that.
Right. We don't have the true crime ending to this.
That's true.
We need to know.
I know. This is how I think we were talking about this yesterday, Alan, how you asked me why I like true crime so much, or in the past few days.
Mm-hmm.
And I was saying, like, to me, like, the first experience I had with true crime besides In Cold Blood was the podcast Serial. And the fascinating part of Serial is that it really introduces you to all of these characters. It's about the murder of Haman Lee. And then it leaves you without any resolution and you just can't stop thinking about it. You know, and I kind of feel the same way about this case where it's like, that's really the tie in a lot of times is like, you just want this thing to be resolved.
But I mean, unless something has happened, she's a teenager now. This is a current thing.
Yeah, no, I know. But I mean, obviously we haven't heard of like some huge fire starter in the Philippines. Like, she must have gotten it under control,
or the government swooped in and now she's in a lab somewhere.
It's true. That's a good point.
Yeah, that's true. She's gonna be the like basis for genetically engineering superheroes.
Yeah, like X-Men.
Mm-hmm. Can we do like a deep dive episode after COVID where we go to the Philippines and try to find this girl?
Yes. Oh my goodness. I would like a on the scene.
Yeah.
We can bring our mobile recorders.
Our right. Mobile recorders.
It's a point of contention, Bob, because specifically in the Halloween radio drama that we did with Jollyville, Michael mm-hmm. and I wrote this thing into the script about the main character taking her mobile recorder, because that's the only way we could motivate the character to like not be in this one spot. She's right. Like a radio host. And Alan is all up in arms that mobile recorders are not a thing that she would just take at a radio station. So now it's an inside joke that, oh, we'll just take all our mobile recorders and go to the Philippines.
I love it.
That's being taken very out of context.
Okay.
But still, yeah, you're not going to have like a little mobile transmission unit inside a radio station to broadcast live.
But news people are all over the place.
Yes, they are.
Okay.
We've had this conversation
right.
before. We've
we'll
gone to the technics.
What did I do?
But yeah, for everyone out there, yes, mobile recorders exist. We're using a mobile recorder right now.
Case in point.
No, not case in point.
Okay. So in conclusion, pyromania is wrongly used to describe arson in much of pop culture. Pyrokinesis, a term actually coined by Stephen King in recent history, refers to a supernatural, fictionalized ability to set fires. But again, it's not connected to the disorder of pyromania. You can be both a pyromaniac and a pyrokinetic. Any act of setting a fire with malintent, or specifically to harm someone, is arson, not pyromania. All right, Alan. Now we are up to the famous pop culture section.
Okay. What do you want to know?
Well, so we should say that very important to this from 1980 is Stephen King's book Firestarter, obviously, right? I will also say that there seems to be, just based on my very preliminary research around books, there seems to be quite a few like romantic type novels that have pyromaniac and pyrokinetic lead characters. And I didn't do a lot of pulling titles for those, but if you're interested, you can find them quite easily online.
Freud would have a field day.
Yeah, exactly. But for movies, Alan, we watched Firestarter, but you also watched many more movies.
I did, but we'll talk about Firestarter first.
Okay.
So, I mean, curious on your thoughts, Bob, but I don't think she was a pyromaniac.
No.
I think she was simply a pyrokinetic.
Yeah, well, absolutely, because I agree. Because she's not, any time in the movie that she was acting, she was using her ability, it was to defend herself or to escape from a situation. It was never just something she was doing because she had like the cognitive need to do it.
I believe it was revenge arson.
Yeah.
Well, and if we think about like the trope with any of these if you look at the umbrella term, like the telekinesis stuff, you know, where people are maybe using their telekinesis to like snap somebody's neck in self-defense or starting fires in self-defense. Like a lot of the times we're looking at them in the beginning of the novel or the movie as like a young kid, and they're often like afraid of their powers as they don't feel like they have control of it. Or then they feel like a lot of deep remorse or you know, just internal struggles and difficulty when they do have to eventually use it in a way that hurts somebody. And so it's like almost the opposite.
What did you think? I don't know how recently you've watched it, Bob, but like Alan and Bob, what did you think of the movie Firestarter?
I wasn't in love with it.
I read the book. I don't think I saw the movie. It's got Drew Barrymore, doesn't it? As a little
kid. Yeah, and it's just an interesting side note. Drew Barrymore at that age is identical to my sister when she was that age, and it was very hard to watch the movie and not separate that.
Physical appearance, not tell it.
Yeah, yes, physical appearance, yes.
Excuse me, pyrokinetic ability.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't know. Overall, I thought the movie, like, I don't know that I would direct people to watch it. I think if you're interested in learning about pyrokinesis and pyromania, like, you have to. It's kind of like the pinnacle text that exists both in book form and movie form. But beyond that, the movie itself, I think, was kind of came across as a little dated and slow, perhaps. But again, that's just my millennial point of view on it.
I did think that her powers are possibly the best manifestation of an on-screen D&D fireball that you'll ever see. You really felt the weight behind him, and you rarely get that in movies.
The pyrokinesis in the film is done really well, I think. Like, that has not aged. Like, the effects are kind of crazy. Like, people are set on fire and launched into trees, and, you know, like, that movie was, like, very tricky to make.
I mean, yeah, they had to burn a lot of people.
extras.
Quite literally. They had so many people just in, like, the flame-retardant suits and, like, the rubber masks that, you know, painted to look like faces just so they can light people on fire.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people get lit on fire.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
It's a really good book. It's been a while since I've read it, but I don't know how it tracks with the film. But it's dark. I remember that one specifically being really, even more kind of, even for Stephen King, like it's very sad, but it's a track off The Shining. And I think the Firestarter kid, does she come back in Dr. Sleep? I can't remember, but it's
interesting. I haven't, dabbled in Dr. Sleep yet, but that I would be very interested to check out. In some ways, I feel like it reminded me of Pet Sematary, in that Pet Sematary is also like very scary, but more so almost like the horrors of it are how sad it is and devastating, this thing that happens to the family. And I feel kind of the same. It's like this familial devastation of, you know, I don't want to give anything away, but some of that seems very connected to the emotions that Pet Sematary elicits when you read the book.
Well, it's kind of like what we talked about before, like especially with a lot of Stephen King, you know, sometimes the real monster is the the traumas and stuff that are being portrayed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, another film that I watched leading up to this, and I was so excited to watch this movie because I've had the DVD for so long, and you know,
what year is it? Where did you get this DVD?
Well, the movie's from 2000, so sometime after that, and
before. And you just never watched it, but you just kept it and moved it from apartment to apartment.
That's correct.
Okay,
it's a Japanese film simply called Pyrokinesis.
Mm. Hmm.
And it's super fucking cool.
Oh, cool.
I was thoroughly unprepared to enjoy this movie as much as I did. And so this is, you know, before the renaissance, if you will, of the superhero film. And it's a pretty, actually, I was about to say straightforward story, but it's not straightforward at all. There's actually like layers and layers of, you know, subplots and alternative agendas and everything. But there's a gang that's just targeting women. Mm-hmm. A gang of like teenage guys.
Yeah.
This is a Japanese film. It's like, you know, on the streets of Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just targeting teenage girls and abusing and murdering.
Jeez.
And someone's sister gets harmed, and there's another girl that has pyrokinetic abilities, and she's just suppressed it her whole life because she knows it's bad. And but now she, you know, she has a purpose. She's going to just go get revenge. And it escalates.
It's like John Wick, I feel like.
Sorta. But there's a lot of other factors at play. Because also, like, she's not just like some badass. She's just a perfectly, well, very mentally unstable person.
Mm-hmm.
She has no outlet to use her powers until this moment, and she finally has a time to try to use them for good. But it's a power that involves nothing but destruction.
Right.
So there's not a whole lot of good that can come of it. One thing that I really liked about this film was its kind of deep dive into the fundamentals of pyrokinesis.
Mm.
And so one, you know, when we think of that, you know, I think most people are most, when they think pyrokinesis, they think like Pyro from X-Men,
mm-hmm.
who, yeah. I was about to say, he just shoots fire out of his hands, right? But he doesn't even shoot fire out of his hands. He can't create fire. He can just control fire. So he can just send fire into different places. But, you know, it's basically not just like someone that can just like make people burst into flames. Well, sorry, in her case it is, but it is the very fundamental manipulation of energy. So what that means is that, yes, you have full control over atoms and their movement. So you can make them accelerate to cause something to instantly burst into flames. You can cause them to decelerate to cool.
Mm-hmm.
So what that means is telekinesis, so the ability to move things around, would be a subset of pyrokinesis. So you can move things around because you can already have the full control over the movement of atoms.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's discovering all of these new powers, which is, this actually came into play a bit in Firestarter.
Yeah.
Because they shoot at her and the bullets just kind of like ping off.
Well, they burst into flames. She bursts them into flames, I think, as they're getting close.
Well, right. I guess so. Like what? She just literally burns the bullets away.
Yeah.
That's pretty intense.
Yeah. That's how I interpreted it.
Gotcha. Yeah, so it's, yeah, you basically make a heat shield where just it's so hot that nothing can physically get mm-hmm. through it. Atoms just kind of disperse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, that could be it, too, because they do talk about how she physically gets so hot, right? Like, so maybe it is just that, you know, she has some kind of heat shield around her.
Actually, getting into more, we discussed this very briefly early on, the story of Prometheus.
Yeah.
So, you know, the idea of fire solely being a tool of the gods,
mm-hmm.
and any human that can control, has the power of, to control fire, has the power of a god. And this actually fell into another film that I watched leading up to this. I don't know if either of you familiar, it's actually a movie that came out just last year. It's called Mortal.
No.
Very, very cool movie. Huge fan. It's based in Norse mythology. And it takes, I really don't want to give anything away from this movie because it's just so, the plot development is really cool for anyone that especially just knows some of the Norse myths.
this different than the movie Pyromania or Pyromaniac? That's a Norwegian drama. Did you watch that movie?
They might have different names. Is it? Well, no, that's from 2016. This is from 2000.
So interesting. We got a little bit of a fire fascination in Norway cinema.
But in this case, his pyrokinetic abilities come from the fact that he's discovering godly power.
Yeah.
And so that's just like the first step because, yeah, you're doing very fine manipulation of atoms. What is that if not godly power?
Mm. Right.
Frankenstein.
This is fascinating. Like, my mind is just all over the place right now thinking about, what's a subset of what in terms of actually thinking about the pyrokinesis aspect. You remember in Star Trek Voyager where Kes was like honing in her telekinesis in one episode and she sits there and like makes the tea boil, I think, on a table. It's that same thing. What is heat? Well, it's atoms moving at a faster rate. So like that's what this is in its fundamentals. If you have the ability to control that, that's what you would do to start the fire.
They touch on this, in X-Men lore, how, you know, a lot of anyone that has some kind of mental powers in general, they're usually just different subsets of each other. And then you can, you escalate all the way up to like Dark Phoenix, who is a universe level type character. Yeah, it's cool because it's more of just a spectrum instead of like a branching tree.
Mm. Right.
As is life, really, you know?
Mm.
Yep.
Okay, so a few other movies that I have not watched but seem to be important to the genre. We mentioned Pyromaniac from 2016, which is a Norwegian drama. There's a movie called Pyromaniac's Love Story from 1995. A movie called Don't Go in the House, 1980. There's also a Firestarter, I don't know if it's a reboot or a sequel. It's called Firestarter Rekindled from 2002.
It's the sequel to Firestarter.
Sequel, got it. A movie called Alone in the Dark from 1982. The Exterminator from 1980. And Evidence from 2013. But we have a few interesting episodes of television also to cover off on. So, my favorite show, The X-Files, Season 1, Episode 12, an episode called Fire. Mulder and Scully encounter a villain who can produce fire from his bare hands, qualifying him as a pyrokinetic. Also, an episode, and I've never seen the show Beavis and Butthead, but this one is kind of interesting. So, there's a bit of history with the Beavis character. Many believed him to be a pyromaniac because of his fire chance, though we now know that is not enough, obviously, to diagnose him as a pyromaniac. Tragically.
Sorry, I just love it. Let's discuss this Beavis character.
Sorry.
Let's like psychoanalyze.
I'm not in my comfort zone here.
Beavis.
Tragically, there was a case in Ohio where a mother claims that her son was inspired by Beavis's fire chant to burn down her trailer, which actually killed his sister. And after this happened, the show writers changed his chant to Friar Friar or Liar Liar.
Friar?
Yeah, like
Friar
a,
Tuck?
Like a friar, like a, I think like a grease, like a, at a diner, like a friar.
Oh, gotcha. Not like frock.
So there's also a character in the anime Fooly Cooly.
Fooly Cooly, yes.
Or FLCL, called Mamini Samjima, and she is a pyromaniac and also a high school student, and the idea is that she sort of rarely goes to school. She's very truant, and sort of as part of this, she is a pyromaniac. Have you seen that show, Alan?
I'm familiar with it. I have not seen it.
Got it. And then also Stephen King, we have Trash Can Man. Trash Can Man is a supporting character in the show The Stand, which is based again on a Stephen King novel. He's a pyromaniac, and some also think that he's a schizophrenic. Have you seen that?
I've not. I actually haven't delved too deeply into Stephen King, simply because I feel like there's such an order to things, and how to I love being able to appreciate a novel and get all the references. But in order to do that, you need to read all his previous stuff because there's just so many little characters and callbacks and stuff. Like, for instance, I've always wanted to read the Dark Tower series, but I can't do that until I spend like a few years simply reading his novels.
You could totally start with Dark Tower series.
You think so?
Yep.
Okay.
I've
been told otherwise that it's just like, oh no, there's just gonna be so many references you'll never get.
We should make a pact. You read the Dark Tower series and I'll read Dune.
Oh boy.
Yes. All of it. It's all so great. The thing with the Stephen King stuff is just know that if you've read some novels of his before you read the Dark Tower series, once you read the Dark Tower series, everything else that you read of his is going to have an entirely different meaning.
Oh,
and that's where I'm saying, like, you could definitely start with the Dark Tower series, but he really did this amazing job of making an epic that tied in literally everything else that he'd ever written.
Wow. Would you recommend starting with the Dark Tower series?
If you've never done any Stephen King at all, I mean, yeah, just dive in wherever you feel comfortable. You could just pick up a one-off novel, or you could start with Dark Tower series. I really don't think you're going to go wrong.
Read okay. Salem's Lot.
There you go.
That's so good, Salem's Lot.
Salem's Lot plays heavily into the Dark Tower series, and having read that first would, yeah, probably make you would probably have a more enjoyable time once you got to like book 5 of the Dark Tower series.
Okay. Wow. Salem's Lot it is.
Yeah, Salem's Lot and then Dark Tower series and then Dune. That's the problem for me with like some of these things. It's just like they're so dense, you know? It's like intimidating to get started on it.
Yeah, I mean, Dark Tower was like years of my life going through those books. I do want to say though, because we got to the Trash Can Man. So I've read The Stand, the unedited, unabridged version, which is super long. And I remember when I was a kid watching they did a mini series of it with like Gary Sinise. And then they just did another mini series of it that ended, I think, a few weeks ago.
Yeah, I saw that.
I don't know if it was Prime or Netflix or what, but I watched that too. And that I have to say, like, the Trash Can Man is definitely a really good, realistic portrayal in fiction of what I would think a pyromaniac would be in real life.
Oh, awesome.
Cool.
That is a actual great one to highlight for this show, because it's just he's just a guy whose life has been consumed by fire and starting fires and doing that stuff. The schizophrenia thing, I don't know. They don't portray any kind of like psychosis, like hallucinations or delusions necessarily that I've noticed. But yeah, definitely the pyromania part.
I mean, that's really good to know, because every time, like, I'm trying to think of other instances in fiction, because yeah, usually they tie pyromania and pyrokinesis together into a character just to kind of make the trope. And it's just, yeah, this person that can produce fire, has some kind of fire powers, and is also this just like edgy, unstable character that's just wants to see everything burn.
Right.
I think that might wrap things up pretty well for us to end with an example that ties back to the root of what we started talking about today, which was defining pyromania.
Yeah.
So Bob, thank you. Oh my goodness. We had so much fun recording this, but also I've had so much fun just talking to you and getting to know you, listening to your podcast. So I'm so excited to keep listening to Bob's Short Story Hour, but hopefully to keep collaborating and working together.
Absolutely. Yeah, this has been a blast, and it's fun because, you know, with podcasts, like you get people into your ears and you really feel like they're just your buddies. And it's the same with me. Like, I listen to Lunatics Radio Hour every week now, and I've gone back and listened to a bunch of your old stuff. I'm almost like caught up with the whole show.
Oh my gosh, that's such an honor, really. That to us is mind blowing, because some of the old ones are rough. So we really appreciate that.
Oh man, it's
and,
how it goes.
Just a special thanks, you know, from me to you. You know, anyone out there that is just you know, really getting more Wendigo content into the universe, just a special thank you. I really appreciate it.
That was a fun one. I really liked that story.
As did I.
Good. Thank you. I'm so excited to do a show on my podcast with you guys where I want to just nerd out and go back and be like, I wish I had been there for this episode, because I would have told you about this story.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very, very on board.
Yeah. We'll have to set that up soon.
Cool.
Also, Bob very recently on Bob's Short Story Hour did an episode where he reads 3 of my short stories, which is a huge honor. And it's so awesome to hear. I say this all the time, but to hear people who are very talented at reading stories read my work makes them sound so much better. So I am thrilled with that episode. We'll leave a link to that in this description, but please go back and listen to that. And on the next episode of Lunatics Radio Hour is going to be a Lunatics Library episode. Of course, we could not let the chance to write some pyrokinesis stories go unturned. So Bob very graciously is going to read some of those stories for us in the next episode. So make sure you stay tuned and listen to the finale, if you will, of Pyromania and Pyrokinesis. Well, thank you all so much for listening, as always. Check us out at lunaticsproject.com for our brand new website, which has tons of resources. And Bob, where should people follow and listen to you?
Anywhere podcasts can be found. You can find Bob's Short Story Hour and Hidden Oaks. We're the one with the oak leaf, like black oak leaf on a white background, not the football podcast, which is like Hidden Oaks something else. So, and all the social media is just the names of the shows, and people will find me if they want to.
Perfect. And also, I should say, I just read a book, a very disturbing book that I keep talking about on the podcast, called My Lovely Wife. And I almost emailed you this, but the story takes place in a development called Hidden Oaks. And it's just like, I feel like it's it's funny how, you know, how dark and spooky now I associate Hidden Oaks on so many levels.
That's funny. The park, the Hidden Oaks, like that's in all of our stories in the show. That's a real place, not too far from here.
Oh, wow.
I love that. Michael Crosa for Jollyville does that, too. It's always funny to see the namesake of things. Awesome. Well, thank you guys again so much. And until next time, goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like some bonus content, consider supporting us on Patreon to access our patron-exclusive podcast, Horror Movie Club.
Also, head to lunaticsproject.com to check out our spooky merch and apparel.
You can find us at Lunatics Project on Twitter and TikTok, and The Lunatics Project on Instagram and YouTube, where you'll find our short horror films, cemetery tours, and so much more.
And please rate and review. A little feedback goes a long way to help us grow and get more content out there.
Our cover art is by Pilar Kep, and musical bumpers are by Michaela Papa and Jordan Moser.